Today is Friday, September 1st, 2006. My name is Sandy Fahler, and I am an interviewer with the University of Wisconsin-Madison Oral History Project. Today, I am interviewing Annie Stunden, recently retired Chief Information Officer and Director of the University of Wisconsin-Madison Division of Information Technology. Good afternoon.
Hi, Sandy.
We're going to start the interview by asking you to talk about your early life, where and when you were born, describe your childhood, your early schooling, talk about your family. Were there any family members, teachers, or other people that influenced you in your future career?
Sure. I was born in Brooklyn, New York in 1935, December 6th, 1935, a long time ago. And, I come from a working class family. My dad was a New York City fireman. My mom was a homemaker. Both of them were children of immigrants, so my grandparents emigrated to this country in the late 1890s, the very late 1890s. So my parents were first generation English speakers. My mother was from a big Irish Catholic family, and my father was from a much smaller German Lutheran family. I'm the first child. I'm the oldest child in this family. We were living in Queens, New York, and I do remember going to public school 118, walking back and forth every day. And it's interesting, you know, what teachers do you remember? The teacher I remember the very best was my kindergarten teacher, Mrs. Wolf. I just adored her. She was kind, thoughtful, interesting, and a good friend to me and to my family. My childhood was complicated. As I say, I'm the oldest child, and my sister was born 2.5 years later, and she was very sickly. So she was an asthmatic who was being rushed to the hospital frequently in the middle of the night because she couldn't breathe. And she was the first person on the East Coast to have penicillin. My family got it from the local military base. It was made first available to the military, and this was in the 40s during World War II. And my doctor, our family doctor, said, you know, I think this might help. My sister had a large bacterial infection, so we had that issue. And then shortly after that, she had polio. She was one of the polio victims just before the first vaccines come out. So my family was complicated by that. I was clearly the oldest child, and I thought I was the favorite child, and I probably was, but that's because I could just go about my life. My sister, however, got most of the attention in the family. So there was that. And then when I was 13, and this was just before my sister's polio, my family accidentally had another baby. And, you know, and that's a funny story in itself. But people didn't know a lot about birth control back then, right? And certainly my family didn't. I didn't realize this until later. And my dad, who had always wished he had more education, was going to chiropractic school. Mm-hmm. And he came home, I heard, from chiropractic school, having learned that women have cycles. Nobody knew that before in the house. And that if you had intercourse, it's a funny story, at the right time of the month, you wouldn't get anybody pregnant. So he and mother gave this a whirl, as did a friend of his who he was going to school with and his girlfriend, and both my mother and this girlfriend ended up pregnant. So we had another baby in our family who was the first boy who was extraordinarily healthy. But because of my sister's then polio, I ended up as the primary caretaker for my brother. And we talk about this, all of us, to this day. It was hard. It was interesting, and it was hard. I was a good student in my early years, in kindergarten and first grade and second grade and third grade. I mean, I was wonderful. I skipped grades and I did all of that kind of stuff. But I began deteriorating as a student as I hit adolescence. And I don't remember high school as a wonderful event at all. I just remember having to do the work I needed to do to get through. And I remember also not being... You know, I was always on the fringes of the most popular, most successful groups. I was never part of them, and I was never not part of them. So I was always unsure of who I was. Nobody in my family had been to college, so my father was the oldest son of two, and my mother had a lot of brothers and sisters, but I think I was the oldest child all through both families. And my father, who had always wanted to go to college and had managed to go to Hunter's Teachers College for just a year, was determined that his daughter was going to go to college. I mean, that was one of the things that was high in his life. So he always had me set for that, for going to college, even though I didn't quite understand what it was about, and nor did anybody else, right? So we're there in New York in the early 1950s. And my dad had retired from the fire department with a heart condition and was looking and was working for an insurance company as an insurance adjuster, and lost his job. And he came home and said, well, you know, I'm not going to find another job here. We're going to go to Connecticut. And then in a couple of years, when Judy, my sister, finishes school, maybe we'll move to California. And he said that to his baby brother, who said, oh, you're not going to move to California. If you move to California, I'll kiss your ass in Macy's window. So my father came home and said, well, we're moving to California right now. And he took the living room, and he measured the size of a rental truck, and then he put a rope up in the living room the size of a rental truck to see if he could pack the whole household belongings in this. Now, mind you, I'm 16 at the time. My sister is 13 with polio, and my brother is 5 or 4, or, you know, somewhere at ages like this. So my daddy's packing up the living room, the truck in the living room, and my mother is getting sicker every day. And she gets car sick. And he has said, well, I'm going to get Annie, that's me, a driver's license, and she'll drive the car, and I'll drive the truck. And my mother was just freaking out. So she called her doctor and said, this is what Eddie is doing to me, Dr. Stahl. And Dr. Stahl said, Julia, call the airlines and buy an airplane ticket, buy airplane tickets. Now, this again is the 1950s, yeah. And nobody in this family has been on an airplane except me. I went on one tiny little trip upstate New York once when I was 15 or something. So he said to me, okay. Everybody said, okay. And Dad said, can you graduate from high school 6 months earlier? And I said, probably. So I went to summer school and graduated from high school in January 1953, and we got on an airplane the next day, and I started UCLA the day after that. When I had said at high school that I was going to go to UCLA, most of the girls my age were going to be secretaries or already had their boyfriends and were going to be married. I mean, this is working class, and this is 1953. Mm-hmm. So when I went to my high school guidance counselor saying I wanted to apply to UCLA, they said, oh, you're not going to go to UCLA. If anything, you're going to go to Queens College or Hunter College. I mean, you can't go to UCLA. And I said,
so you knew this before you were going to move to California, that you wanted to go to...
This was once we were moving to California. Then I had to go... There was nothing about going away to school either. That was not in anybody's mind.
Right.
So, you know, you just were going to go to whatever school you were near that you could commute to. Mm-hmm. I mean, going to college was big enough, let alone going away.
Right.
So I applied to UCLA and sometime in this process, and I was accepted. And you know, you had to write an essay. That's something else I remember. And I had gotten one of the highest grades in New York State on the English Regents. And I failed the UCLA dumbbell English test. Well, you know, I know what was happening. I'm clear about it. I'm a stream of consciousness writer, and I wrote a stream of consciousness essay about this big move and how hard it was without the right punctuation or grammar and so on. And they put me in a dumbbell English class at UCLA, which was easy, if nothing else, and a little bit of a waste. But so that's how I got to UCLA. The person who clearly encouraged me in all of this was my father. He was, as opposed to teachers, he was determined that this daughter of his, who he knew was bright, was going to go to college, and because he didn't get to go, and I was going to go. And it was not an easy experience. It was a very painful experience. For starters, after my first semester, I didn't speak the language. I had a very big Queen Street kid accent. And so I talked funny. I dressed funny. There are things you remember, you know. In New York, one of the things that was in were big, fat socks. It was cold in New York in January. So we wore big, thick socks, and then we rolled them down so that at our ankles, there must have been something 3 inches thick around our ankles. And I remember people looking at my feet and pointing and laughing. So, you know, it was very hard. My first semester, I sort of got through, not with great grades, but I got through. And so I started in February. And during the summer, the phone company was interviewing for operators. And those were operators where you plugged things into the switchboard and said, number, please. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the phone company and applied for a summer job. And they hired me. And I loved it. I simply loved it. I learned it very quickly. The phone company liked me because I was smart. They wanted to keep me and put me in their management training program. I thought that was a wonderful idea. I didn't want to go back to UCLA. And I talked to my mother about it, and she didn't understand why I was going to college. I mean, it was not something in her mindset, it was in my father's. And so we were sort of thinking, well, we'll just sort of avoid the issue with my father for as long as we can. And with my mother, she said, it's fine, you can do that. And one day, I'm at the switchboard, and it's toward the middle of August, and I'm in downtown LA, and my daddy's in the San Fernando Valley. And by the way, he had gotten another job, so he was working. Mm-hmm. And he appears at the phone company and looking for his daughter, Ann Ellen Kareth. And they said, she's on the switchboard, she's working right now. And he said, it doesn't matter, she's not working anymore. She's only 17 years old, she's a minor, she's my daughter, and she's finished work right now. So he took me home and sent me back to UCLA. And this is...
He was determined.
He was determined. And did I hate him for it? Of course. Am I ever grateful? What? You know, of course. I mean, it was... But, you know, would I do that to my children? I don't think so. You know, so it was an interesting experience. I was majoring... I wanted to be a school teacher, because that's the only thing I understood that made sense. If you went to college and you were a girl, because you were girls, not women, those mm-hmm. days, you were either studying to be a school teacher or a nurse. I mean, those maybe a social worker. I'm not sure that those things existed. And my father didn't like the idea of my being a nurse. He thought being a school teacher was okay. As a matter of fact, he said, if you're going to be a nurse, you might as well be a doctor. And that was something I wasn't going to consider. So I decided I was going to be a school teacher, and I wanted to teach high school, and I wanted to teach high school English. And so I was floating along there, taking whatever I needed to be able to do that. And my education and my career are not related at all. And I had to take a course in speech. And in the speech course, I found that I had to give speeches, you had to write speeches. And I loved writing, even though I didn't do well in this dumbbell English course. I was a really good writer. And I loved writing, and so I figured, you know, if I could write in speech courses, I'm going to take some more of these. And so to major in speech then, you had to take a course in speech therapy, and I fell in love with it. Mm-hmm. And I know why I did, because it wasn't just studying things that you couldn't put your hands on. It was actually studying something that you were going to do. And I like to do things. I'm a doer. I've learned that I'm really a builder. Back then I didn't understand that, but and as part of majoring in speech therapy, you got to work with children with speech disorders, adults with speech disorders, and so not only could I study, but I could work and do things. So I've got a bachelor's degree in speech pathology from UCLA, and I ended up in graduate school in that field.
Right away? You went into graduate school right away?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Right. I was working part-time all of this time. I worked in bakeries. I worked at Sears in the customer service department taking complaints. And once I threw a shoe at a customer, my boss told me to go sit down. How could I do something like that? And then he came back and said, you're right, he deserved having a shoe thrown at him. So I ended up teaching in the Fernald School on the UCLA campus, which was a school for children with emotional disorders, and doing speech therapy, and then ended up with an internship at a state psychiatric hospital working with aphasics. So I was doing all of that as part of my last year as an undergraduate and my graduate education. I tell this story about falling in love in graduate school, messing up my academic career, and dropping out of graduate school. That's partially true, and the other part was you had to take a language exam. And yeah, I was not getting it with the foreign language. So it was an opportunity to drop out, and I did. And once I dropped out, I said, well, I've got to find a job. And System Development Corporation was advertising at the time. We're now up to 1959. Systems Development Corporation was advertising for, they said human factors specialists. And I went down there to talk to these people and said, I know something about psychology and something about statistics. And they said, you're exactly what we want. We will hire you and we'll pay you $320 a month. And I said, great. And this is not a bad salary in 1959. And I said, you know, what's this other thing in this advertisement? It says computer programmer. What is that? And they said, oh, we're giving the test right now. Why don't you go take it? And I walked in, and I was the last one in and the first one out, because I'm good at that logic stuff. And they looked at me, and they looked at my test scores and said, well, how would you like to be a computer programmer? We'll pay you $430 a month. And I said, that's great. I'll take it. And I had no idea what it was about. And neither, it turns out, did anybody else. So this is 1959. SDC, if you don't know what it is, was a spin-off of the RAND Corporation. RAND stands for Research and No Development. And they don't do development, and so they had this huge contract with the Air Force to design a system to prevent missile and airplane attacks on the United States. And once the design was finished, they spun off a sub-company, SDC, to do the development. And SDC was looking for people to do this work. And there weren't people, of course. I mean, there were no degrees in computer science. There were very few people who really had any concept of what this was about. So I was very fortunate, and they were hiring very bright young kids who could pass this test off the street. They were hiring math majors and other science majors and a few musicians. I certainly was the only speech therapist. They hired some really smart 19-year-olds who, you know, were college dropouts, just a couple of them. And it was wonderful. I mean, we were a huge club. And we were all learning together because, of course, the first thing you do is go into a training program and immerse yourself in this for 8 hours a day for anywhere from 6 weeks to 6 months, depending on what your assignment was going to be. I loved it, and it was an interesting experience, too. I'll never forget. I mean, I got the coding part really, really quickly, but I just didn't have a good math and science background. And I remember the instructor looking at the class and saying, would you please write a program to convert polar coordinates to Cartesian coordinates? And everybody in the class puts their head down and starts to work. And I'm sitting there saying, what is he talking about? And I finally raised my hand and said, excuse me, Ted, but what's a coordinate? Not even what's a polar coordinate or a Cartesian coordinate, but what's a coordinate? The class tittered. They very graciously explained it to me, and I sat down and wrote a program to convert polar coordinates to Cartesian coordinates. And That's how I got into this business. So what was my major? I mean, I'm looking at the list of questions right, here, Sandy, right. And I think I've got through them. What was my major and how did I choose it? Talk about any courses and our instructors that stand out in your mind.
Had nothing to do with what
It had nothing to do with what I do. I mean, there were a couple of instructors who I just, teachers, faculty members who I adored. Both of them were in speech pathology, which is, you know, partly why I was there.
Right.
And were truly mentors and supporters and, you know, got me through that. But it doesn't have anything to do with how I got to where I am. And what does have, of course, is the time. It was the time when people wanted when people were needed to do this work and people were not trained to do it. So I was really fortunate.
So how long did you stay with SDC then?
Well, yeah, let's do that next part of it.
Okay.
I stayed with SDC for my first stint from 59 to 64. And the reason I left in 64 was I was pregnant. And you had to leave work 6 weeks before you had a baby, right? Mm. And you had to have a doctor's note that said when the baby was going to be delivered, was due, and you had to turn that in, and that was the last day you could work, 6 weeks before the baby was coming. I had gotten married in the middle of this mm-hmm. process, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I left work. And I had, you know, you have to remember, I have to keep remembering when I was raised. I was born and raised in 1935, born at 35, raised in the 40s. My assessment of who I was going to be was a wife and mother forever. And education, I mean, the education was so that you would have a job to fall back on, which even my father had said,
mm-hmm.
it's to so you have something to fall back on. By the way, my sister, my sister got her PhD. I mean, she ended up as somebody who people said will never get to college. And that's because her undergraduate, her lower school education was so spotty, she didn't have the information. And if people thought if you didn't have the information, you weren't smart. So she has a PhD, and my brother became a plumber because Dad pulled him out of college. He wanted to be an artist. And when he got this plumbing thing. So my father was an interesting man in mm-hmm. all of our lives. But SDC was till 64, and then I quit because I was going to go home and do what I was supposed to do, really, that I was born to do, was to be a wife and mother.
What was your husband doing at the time?
My husband was getting his PhD in psychology from UCLA and working, I don't remember where he was working at that time.
Mm-hmm.
But he certainly was, he did have a full-time job,
mm-hmm.
and he was a dissertator, and it took him a long, actually by 64, by the time I was pregnant, he was finishing his dissertation.
Mm-hmm.
And shortly after the baby was born, he got the PhD.
Mm-hmm.
But he, during this time, so Julie is born, and I'm home trying to do what it is, and he's invited to a position at Western Michigan University. And he was in speech pathology, too. We're one of the leading speech pathologies in the nation. The pathologist in the nation, his name was Charles Van Riper, was teaching at that time. So we up and moved to Kalamazoo, Michigan, with a new baby, a little dog, and a husband with almost a PhD. And we're there for a year and a half. But after a few months there, I was going stir crazy.
Mm-hmm.
I absolutely couldn't stand staying home and cooking and cleaning, even though my baby was beautiful, and doing whatever it was. And the husband said, it's okay if you want to go get a job, you know. Well, I don't know much about Kalamazoo, so I called the university and asked Western Michigan University what was happening, and they said, why don't you go talk to the IBM office in town? And I went and talked to the IBM office, and this guy, whose name was Jim Henry, was the director of that office, and he said, I'll hire you as a systems engineer. So, and that was interesting in itself. I became a systems engineer for IBM, and I stayed there during our time period at in Kalamazoo. But universities are funny places. The world is a funny place. And it was unacceptable to the faculty and the faculty wives for me to have this new baby at home and be working at IBM.
Oh.
You know, that was just not something that a good faculty wife should do.
Now, IBM could have cared less. Did they ask you any questions about your
family? No. I got along really well with Jim Henry, and he just hired me.
Sure.
You know? And I was a good systems engineer, and I was working in, I mean, I had been developing these wonderful big air defense systems. I was doing, when I was at STC, I was doing system software development. So I was developing operating systems and compilers and tape management systems and drum. We didn't have this then, we had drums, high-speed drums, drum management systems. So I was doing the very basic internal stuff. And I went from there to this IBM office where we're serving small customers on new machines, seven something or others, and in COBOL and RPG, which in my mind were extraordinarily dumb languages. And so I was developing programs for customers trying to take these languages and make them work like I knew how to make assembler language work. Mm-hmm. My programs were extraordinarily efficient, but very hard for most people to debug because they didn't understand what I was doing. But I was a good systems engineer. And I did that for, well, we didn't stay in Michigan very long because my husband was a California boy. And because I was not, I mean, it wasn't acceptable in Michigan for me to be doing that then. At least it didn't feel that in the community that we lived in. Mm-hmm. So we took 2 years, I think, in Michigan and decided to go back to California, which was my family was in California and his family was in California. So I don't think we went, no, we went without him having a job, but he wasn't too worried about it. And IBM offered to transfer me to an LA office.
Oh.
And I did the same thing. I said, oh no, I'm gonna be home. It's gonna be fine to stay home and do babies and my husband and house at home. And we went back and I don't remember what he ended up doing. But the first time I was home for 8 months, and this time I don't even think I lasted 8 months, where I needed to go find another job. So I went back to STC and had an opportunity to work on the next generation of machines, which was very, very exciting. The machine that we were working on, we were building the next generation of the air defense system. The first one was called SAGE, Strategic Air and Ground Environment. And now we were up to Buick, Backup Interceptor Command. And Buick was being built on brand new Burroughs machines. I don't think the machines were commercially available yet, but they were the first machines with multi-processing capability and expanded memory. And I was back in there developing operating systems, and it was wonderful. We were traveling back and forth between Santa Monica, California, and Paoli, Pennsylvania, which is where the Burroughs plant was, and where we could get test time on these machines. And I think doing something pretty wonderful. Mm-hmm. In the meantime, of course, I still wasn't convinced that I shouldn't be being this good wife and mother. And I was working very hard to have another baby. So I got pregnant again, and again, you had to leave work 6 weeks before the baby was born. Fortunately, my babies came early. Either that or I lied. I don't remember much. But we're in California, and I'm back at SDC, and James was born. And I left work again, forever. I mean, every time I left forever, at least those first three times. And had this baby, and tried again to be comfortable being at home. And beside the fact that I was bored, if I went and did anything that wasn't boring, like volunteer work, I felt as if I wasn't earning my own keep, which was interesting. You know, living on somebody else's money, even though I was married to him, just didn't work for me. So I was home for 6 months or so, and Stunden, who was smart enough, and by the way, we've since divorced, but we've remained good friends, said, you're driving me crazy, you're driving these babies crazy, and you're certainly driving yourself crazy. Why don't you go find a job? So I did, and there was a little hospital just 5 minutes from home that was hiring programmers, the kind of programming I had done when I was at IBM. Mm-hmm. So I knocked on the door and talked to an associate director of the hospital, who was a woman, Rosalie Casaba, and we had a wonderful discussion, and then she said, you know, and I don't know what I'm going to do, my manager just gave his resignation in this week, and I've got to recruit a manager too. And I just sort of looked at her, and you know, I'm in my early 30s, and I said, well, would you consider me for a manager? And she said, I would love to. Would you like to be the manager? And that's when I ended up managing my first organization. Before that, I had done some project management work in these positions, but that was my first management job. And I ran this little IT shop off and on for several years. Mm-hmm. And Rosalie was truly a teacher and a mentor. She was not, maybe she was 5 or 6 years older than me. She was going back to school to get her doctorate in public health at the same time as she was being associate director of this community hospital. But she was extraordinarily organized, a really good project manager, and a true mentor and friend. So she supported me and helped me to learn about the things I needed to learn about leadership, or to begin to learn them, and management. And I was at Holy Cross for many years. Let's see, James was born in 68. Trying to remember some of the interesting things about Holy Cross. You know, so I started there in 69. Hang in here 1 second, where am I taking this? Oh, again, it was programming in RPG. Oh, ha! One of the most interesting things there, though, and this is back to women in this business, is I walked in as manager and one of the computer operators quit on the spot. So one of the computer operators, the manager of operations, left on the spot. Another one, I hired two programmers. They were both women. They were older than me. They had gone back to retool themselves because by now we talked about programming. So they had gone to community colleges or technical colleges and learned how to code in RPG again, which we were coding in. So I hired these two women programmers right pretty quickly because there were none. Another operator was really passive aggressive, and he would put the jobs on and disappear while they were waiting for machine time. And so I ended up firing him. And that was, again, he wasn't going to work for a woman and he wasn't going to work with women. It took a while to settle in around that. And I think about how different the times are. I have a picture of myself at an IBM executive program up there in San Jose, California, for data processing managers, hospital data processing managers. And it was me and 15 men in suits. So it was an interesting time. Yeah, I did bring the payroll system down there one weekend. We were taking a system that actually took longer than a weekend to recover from this one. We were taking a system that was all based on cards, just all card input. I can't believe this when I think about computers now, and converting it to tape. And trying to make things faster and more automated. And it was also a week when the Sisters of the Holy Cross, who I worked for, were having a data processing managers meeting in, oh, someplace in Indiana. I think they're right there in Notre Dame, or very close to Notre Dame. So it was conversion week, and I was traveling. And I didn't travel very often. I mean, those were not days when you went places or a job that sent you places, but that was an important meeting and it was an important conversion. And I got a call from my programmers from my friend Rosalie, my boss, saying that when the data was converted, nobody could identify any payments. All of this is accounts payable and accounts receivable that we're converting. And all of the payments were gone. Well, you know, I didn't know anything about accounting. Not a damn thing. I was only just learned things about airplanes and interceptors. And so I just sort of sat there saying, well, you know, you've got all the money from Blue Cross Blue Shield. You've got all the checks in the bank. I don't understand why this is a big deal. I don't understand, of course, why they didn't fire me on the spot.
Oh my.
I think Rosalie protected me on that one. And we worked for months and months and months to collect and to recover as much payroll information as we could recover. That was one of my faux pas. Let me go back to my faux pas with the air defense system. I
I was developing a program called a symbolic corrector program, which was something new before this time. Anybody who was trying to correct their program, until they reassembled, and reassembled meant taking boxes and boxes of cards and sending them over to the computer and recompiling them. They would, until you recompiled, if you needed to fix something on the fly, you submitted something called an octal patch, which had the machine language in it. And I was writing a program that let people correct things using symbolic language. Add, subtract, multiply, instead of 210, 540, 17, 12, branch to 1,064. So I'm writing this program, and I've got it, and I send it out to the field, and it's pretty wonderful. And all of a sudden, the air defense system in the field blows up. Well, somebody had used my program, which was perfect unless you tried to insert an instruction at any place in your program that had an address that was a multiple of 50 octal. It worked at 10, 20, 30, 31, 47, 102. It didn't work at 50. Well, you know, we finally, and we were down for a weekend before anybody really got it. We finally looked at that. We didn't pull the program out of the field. We pulled the fix that this guy was trying to insert at an address that was an integer of 50, and said you can't put any insertions in at any integer of 50 in your program until we found the problem. And it was a good year to solve that problem. And, you know, I mean, it was such a simple solution, and it was a computer operator and I working in the middle of the night debugging. Finally, not in octal, but in binary, where we found the problem. And I had an off-punched instruction. It looked fine when you looked at it, until you looked at it in binary, and there it was. As a matter of fact, I know the instruction. Full cycle left, six, left 16, which would compile as a full cycle left 0100 20, and or 01, I don't remember. And it compiled as a 1 instead of a 20. So those are some of the things. You know, I'm sure I've done other things, none of them quite as nitty-gritty as right there. You know, I know I've made serious management decisions that have been wrong, and I've done hiring that's been wrong, and I've done a lot that's been right. And, you know, if you don't do it wrong, you don't do it, right. I think. Yeah, there's this thing about it's better to do the wrong thing than to do nothing. And, yeah, and I believe that. Doing nothing means you just sit there. Nothing happens. Right. If you do the wrong thing, you can look and say, oh, my God, we've got to change this and do it different. So
back to the hospital.
Oh, yeah, okay. Yeah. So the hospital, well.
What made you leave the hospital?
A divorce. Time to move on. But the hospital itself was interesting. During this time, we had one of the first huge earthquakes in California. So this was 1971 or 72. This is the earthquake of San Fernando, California. It was 6.9 on the Richter scale. And it was in the northeast corner of the San Fernando Valley. The Veterans Hospital, an old Veterans Hospital, the roof collapsed and people died. A brand new county hospital just opened. The first floor was underground and the second floor was at ground level. Mm-hmm. And Holy Cross Hospital, the hospital I worked in, if you walked out to the end, it was a six-story building. If you walked out to the end of the floor, it should have been the end in a wall, you could just walk off and fall to the ground. So we had that experience at the hospital, and it was a while before the hospital administrator was willing to shut the place down. Fortunately, she had a board member who was a general contractor who was in the hospital at the time, and he grabbed her because he was, you know, you used to be able to stay in the hospital for 5 or 6 days to get better, so he was probably someplace late in his stay, and he took her walking down the halls and said, "Sister, you have to close this place. You have to evacuate." So we needed to do whatever you do with computing back then. When you're trying to shut a place down that has just suffered a major catastrophe. And by the way, my house also had, because I was in the same neighborhood, there was nothing upright in my house. Everything was, you know, the refrigerator had turned over and emptied on the floor. There was not a dish that was not broken. The front porch was 4 feet from the front door. And we were on a couple of acres, and I had water pipe, 4-inch pipes, on this acreage, and they were split, and so the yard was geysers.
I've got long earthquake stories. But the hospital itself, you know, we needed to figure out what to do with computing there. My computer operator and key punch operator was at 6 a.m. were both there when this happened because they started early. And the computer was in a different place. These were big computers, not these little things here. Mm-hmm. Was in a different place in its space. The key punch operator was hiding under the key punch. And we needed to figure out what to do. So we did send that computer back to IBM, and leased time on a similar configuration downtown until we managed to convert to a vendor-based system. It was a very interesting time.
Mm-hmm.
Shortly thereafter, but you said, why did I leave? Shortly thereafter, though, I got a divorce, and I decided I needed a geographic cure. So I took a job with Booz Allen in Hamilton. And with it, the office was a New York-based office, but New York City, but they were sending me to Richmond, Virginia to develop systems for the Medical College of Virginia Hospital.
Oh.
So that was my next adventure. And at that point, I picked up and moved across the country with 2 kids, 3 dogs, a few cats, some parakeets, you know. The whole works, and it was easier than it had been to take the Holy Cross job, or, you know, for women, but it wasn't the easiest thing in the world. And Richmond was a strange city to be in. The job was very, very hard. Working in a consulting firm is very painful. They expect the expectations are extraordinarily high for work and more work and more work. But I also had to learn things there that I just, you know, hadn't learned before, like how to stand up and give presentations in front of important people, and how to really write professional documents as opposed to English major papers, and you know, how to organize things and how to project manage. And I taught Booz Allen, their healthcare division, things about what you could do with computers to improve systems and procedures and processes, and what a flowchart was, you know? I mean, they just didn't know what a flowchart was, and how we could really do this work using flowcharts to move it forward.
So they were just entering into this?
They were entering into healthcare IT. They'd been in healthcare for a while, but they hadn't been in healthcare IT. They had another IT branch that was doing a lot of government work, but not their healthcare division.
I see.
So so it was interesting, it was hard, it was exciting. I had a boss who, his name was Jim Reynolds, who didn't know IT, but was extraordinarily smart and did know organization and management, and sort of saw me through a lot of that, as well as the presentation stuff and the project management stuff. And so it was not fun, and I certainly was better for it and better prepared for the next part of my life.
Were you paid well?
Well,
I always thought consulting firms paid pretty well.
You know, let's talk about this. This was 1975. Maybe they gave me $1,200 a month. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that stood in 1975. Yeah. I don't remember. You know, certainly if I could have moved, I know the kids coming out now start those jobs at $100,000, $80,000 to $100,000 a year. But I also, you know, I was not the kind of person, just like I wasn't the kind of person that SDC hired, I wasn't the kind of person they hired. So my colleagues there had their MBAs from Wharton and Harvard and the Kellogg School, as opposed to, you know, somebody who sort of grew up doing this.
Sure.
It was, they were different kinds of people than I was. And the folks, they borrowed a couple of folks from the government IT division, and those folks and I understood each other much better than the people who were part of the organization
I see.
That I was included in.
But it was a great learning experience for leadership.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't like it. What I realized later, and I didn't quite get it, what I realized most I didn't like was you weren't part of anything. So as a consultant, you come and you go, and the organization doesn't think you belong to them.
Mm-hmm.
And the consulting firm only wants you as a body to shop out and make money.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no community. There's no sense of belonging, of being part of something. It's just get this product done and get on and deliver the next product so we can make money from your boss and from your client. It's you're not really part of us. Why aren't you done yesterday? Because you're costing us too much money.
Right. Right.
So I had a colleague there who was in, he was a healthcare guy, who went to Strong Memorial Hospital as part of the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York, as hospital director. And I got a call from him saying, Annie, I need you to come here and run my IT shop. Build an IT shop. Build a planning shop. I need a planning shop. And do something with management engineering. Do you want to come and do this? And I thought, oh my goodness, do I ever. I can leave this Booz Allen place and become part of something. So I went to the University of Rochester and started back in healthcare IT, much different than Holy Cross Hospital. Holy Cross Hospital was a 120-bed community hospital that shrank to like 40 beds after the earthquake and had not built up by the time I left. University of Rochester is one of the major teaching hospitals in the country,
mm-hmm.
with a whole other set of problems, issues, and needs. And there we were moving from homegrown systems to Technicon. Was that the name of the company? Technicon Information Systems, I think. I'm not sure. So we were installing big vendor IT systems. And I did that for 5 or 6 years, built an organization, built a site center because it was, I was running planning, and it was my first opportunity to really pay attention to building a building and working with state agencies and community agencies. By the way, I met my best friend, which remains my best friend there, which is not an IT story, but which is another story. So I'm running the planning department for Holy Cross, for Strong Memorial Hospital, and she is the director of clinical psych programs at a community hospital. And we want to improve our psych center at this big hospital. And the community hospital doesn't want us to do that for fear that that if the state invests money in our place, then they'll turn down any request for more services and programs at this community hospital.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm challenged to get us approval from the state to renovate this major building. And my dearest friend is challenged to keep me from getting that approval because she's running this other program. And we met and looked at each other across the room and said, hey, there's something here. Her boss after that said, I saw that you liked that woman. I don't want you to become friends with her. And that was all Beth needed. And so we've been best friends
nice.
Ever since. And it was interesting because I hate to be sexist about this, but the guys could only see a win-lose situation.
Sure.
And we looked at this and said, this is a win-win situation, And we ended up with both organizations getting what they needed.
Hmm.
But our bosses had no vision that was possible. So life is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So there I was at Strong Memorial Hospital when the vice provost for computing at the university, who I was working with all the time, said, Annie, I need you over here in the university side of the house. And I was fussing with my boss at the time. I don't remember what about, but we were fussing about something. And I said, that's good, Richard. What do you want me to do? And he said, come on over as associate director of computing. And so I did. I transferred from the hospital to the University of Rochester. And when I did that, the organization was in trouble, which is why he wanted me. And he had a revolt on his hands, and it was my job to solve the revolt and
And I did. You know, I sat in a room with these guys saying, what are you doing? And I said, we're going to stay here until somebody talks to me. And they finally did. And they were just miserably unhappy. And I had learned something about management in the hospital and at Booz Allen. So I also learned something about honesty and directness. And, you know, so we got through that. And the director left eventually, and I became director of that organization. And I loved it. It was like I had my home in university IT. And I'd never been happier since my job at SDC developing these air defense systems. So that was it. And I think I did a good job. You know, and those were back in the days when we were just beginning to talk about how to support faculty with technology. Email didn't exist yet, but you had to figure out how to support faculty. You had to figure out how to support students who needed to use SAS and stuff for computing. It was that kind of stuff. I loved it. And we were just also beginning to use desktop computers. They were just coming into play about then, maybe just a year or two before. So I did that, leading that organization for 5 or 6 years. When I was invited to apply for a job at Northwestern. And I thought, oh, what the heck? You know, why not? And my kids by now are grown and could be out of the house. They weren't, that's a different issue, but they should have been. And so I applied for the job as Director of Academic Computing at Northwestern, and I got it. And I moved to Chicago. And that was great fun, because that's really when things were hopping. So email was beginning. More people had desktop computers. We were changing the way that universities used technology.
So now, what year was that, approximately?
Well, I can get the year down.
I might have it.
I've got it, too. It was a 90.
Okay.
90, yeah. You know, the web wasn't there quite yet. Right. But it was on its way before I finished. And, you know, faculty really were thinking differently about how to use technology in classes. We were having a great time building services, building systems to support the campus. And I did that for 5 years.
The guy who hired me left. And I didn't do too well with my new boss, because I'm a pushy broad. And, you know, I mean, he could have done with somebody who was a little more reverent. And that wasn't my style. So when the job at Cornell came up, I had heard that Cornell was interested in me. And so I applied, and I ended up as Director of Academic Computing at Cornell University in upstate New York. And again, had a wonderful time. Things are hopping, we really are using email. We're figuring out how to do lists better. We're just beginning to do Mosaic, which was the precursor to the web. Gopher is out there. Good stuff is out there to support faculty. Help desks are becoming more and more important, because more and more people are using this technology. So you need to have really good help desk, really good front-end services. And I had a grand time with one of the greatest management teams I ever worked with at Cornell, building an organization that really provided good service to the campus community. The faculty support services, multimedia was just popping up there, and how do you do it, and what do you do, and where do you invest? And so we did good work, and I was perfectly happy to stay at Cornell for the rest of my life. Here we go. I got a letter from the University of Wisconsin. I'm up to my career at Madison.
Okay.
Am I doing okay?
Here? You're doing fine. Yeah.
I got a letter from the University of Wisconsin asking me if I would consider being a candidate for their CIO job. And, you know, I wasn't a CIO before that. I was a director of part of these organizations. Mm-hmm. I thought, well, what the hell? You know, as a matter of fact, I was being recruited actively by many places at that time. So I sent in a letter to Cornell saying, sure, I mean to Wisconsin saying, sure, here's my resume. I'd be delighted to hear from you. And at that time, I think one of the schools in San Francisco was recruiting me, and a school in Atlanta was recruiting me, and I was playing with all of these things. Actually, it took a little while. So I've got these things out here, And I didn't hear back from Wisconsin, and I didn't hear back from Wisconsin, didn't hear back from Wisconsin. And I figured, well, you know, and I wasn't paying enough attention. I could have looked to see if they'd hired, but I didn't bother. I just figured, well, they've forgotten all of this stuff. And I didn't want to go to whatever that southern school was, and San Francisco was too expensive to live in, and Cornell was just fine. So I had a deal. I was just about to start renovating my kitchen.
Of course, right?
Yeah. When somebody, I had the plans, I paid for the plans, and somebody called me and said, you're one of our candidates for an interview. Would please come out. So, you know, it began in March, and I didn't hear from them until September. So, which is why you think it's done. Well, of course, they didn't get their search committee started until the fall semester, right? Which is what they're doing again right now. They're just beginning to think about the search committee. They knew I was leaving last November, but that's another story. But of course, we've had provost changes here during that time, too, which has made it complicated. I got this call. I came out, and then they told me I was one of their three finalists, and if I wanted to stay a finalist, of course they had to announce the finalists.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, "Fine, go ahead." And
now, did anything particularly interesting happen in the interview process? Anything that you didn't expect, or
you know, I had gotten really good at interviews, and for a start, I had lots of experience at it over the years. But more than that, I don't lie, I don't obfuscate. I'm directed, I'm clear, mm-hmm. and I have fun. Because if I don't get the job, it's not the end of the world. You
sure.
know, so you can just be who you are. And it was clear to me that a lot of the people on the committee really liked me.
Uh-huh.
So, especially this guy who's sitting right next door right now. I just knew that.
Mm-hmm.
So that I knew that I had done well with the interview committee. And I liked them, too, because they were thoughtful. They were excited about this place. And they really wanted to have somebody new in this job. You know,
mm-hmm.
you could feel that.
Mm-hmm.
And they were interested in what I had to say, as opposed to challenging me to see if I was smart enough. I mean, some
mm-hmm.
of the interviews are like that, but these people didn't do that. They wanted to know what I was thinking, and when I said something, they asked questions, and I wanted to know what they were thinking. So I was pleased with the, this was the committee interview process.
Mm-hmm.
I was just delighted with it. And it turns out, though, that I knew one of the other, we're a small world. So I knew one of the other top candidates. I didn't know the third one, although he and I have since become good friends. We've talked about it. And so the guy who I knew and I had referred him for his last job. I had been recruited for the job that he was in and said, no, I think I was going to Northwestern at the time. No, to Cornell.
Hmm.
I said, you need to talk to Blip. So he and I talked about it and which one of us would be the better candidate for it, which is sort of a fun, you know, fun way to do
mm-hmm.
do it. And he said he thought I'd be the better candidate, and I said I thought I would too. So there we are. They offered me the job. And I was really pleased. And John Wiley was provost at the time. Wiley, John Torfey, who was chief financial officer, and David Ward took me out to dinner and charmed me, and how could you turn this place down?
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, in my mind, this organization had a lot of resources so that you could do things that would really make a difference
mm-hmm.
Here, and I think that we've done that. We use the resources of this organization to bring technology to a much better place for the entire campus. It's a much, the organization is much better at providing front-end service, at helping people. It's gotten really smart about how to manage operations. We're providing a whole set of tools and services that didn't exist. So those, I could see those opportunities. Mm-hmm. The question, of course, is how you move an organization to get there, you know, to take advantage of them. Because the opportunities had been there and they hadn't been doing it. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that was how I got to Madison, the hiring process. Did I describe it enough? Mm-hmm. I mean,
I think so.
Okay.
And this was the first time you were a chief information officer.
Oh, and let me tell you one other interesting thing about that. I looked at the committee. You know, you don't tell people how old you are. But if you look at I told you I was born in 35, so I'm 70. So if you look at my resume, you can tell I graduated from college in 1957. And then I went there straight from high school. So you can pretty well guess at how old I am, right? Mm-hmm. So I looked at these people and I said, you can figure out how old I am. I'm really old. Why are you offering me this job? Why are you even thinking about me? And they said, how long would you give us if you came? And I said, well, I could stay for 5 years. And they said, that's plenty. And we went on with that part, too, which I thought was very interesting.
Absolutely.
So ageism was not running its head.
No.
Sexism was not running its head. And, you know, that's all good stuff.
Yes.
There's something about the
yes.
place. Mm-hmm. That they're willing to take a risk, this kind of position on a woman, on an old broad who hasn't done it before. There you go.
Well, was it a lot different from anything you'd done before?
It was just more.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't a lot different. It was just more. It mm-hmm. was bigger. And the interesting thing for me is, you know, I'm sort of an out there person. I connect with people, and I do people really well. I make friends. I make coworkers. And in any organization I'd worked in before, the largest organization that I had responsibility for was about 130 people. This one has 700 people. So, with students.
Mm-hmm.
So, and with students, I guess before it might have been 170 or something. So, in an organization that size, after 5 years, you can pretty much know the name of everybody. You can even know who their partner is and how many children they have. And so, you can influence the whole organization by dint of your philosophy and your vision and your style.
Right.
In an organization of 700, you can't do that. So that you've got to work with the leaders of the organization differently. You can't get down to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
There's just no way to do it. And of course, I tried. And I couldn't succeed at that. I could hold forums, you know, open forums, come and chat, schmoozing with we ended up with sessions called schmoozing with the CIO, where any one of us in this office would host a luncheon, you know, come and have lunch with one of us and just talk, and anybody could come. But, you know, when you're CIO and you're here and there's 700 people, people are afraid.
Yeah.
And they don't know you as well. So that's the difference. The
mm-hmm.
technology part, well, there's more of it to think about. There's more things to push. There's more exciting adventures to start and keep track of. But it's the people part that's the challenge.
Right, I understand.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Officer and director of the Division of Information Technology. And it took me a while to understand that this place really wanted and was hiring a director of DOIT, the Division of Information Technology. They weren't hiring a CIO, a chief information officer. They didn't know what a CIO was. And if they knew, they didn't want one, because that was too much overall campus responsibility. And the deans didn't want anybody telling them what they might or might not be thinking about IT. Neither did the people who run finance or whatever. Everybody wanted to be their own IT thing out there. And, you know, you do it and do it better than it's been done, and we'll be grateful for it to you, but leave us alone. So my title was CIO and Director of DOIT, but the responsibilities people wanted me to work on were primarily organizing DOIT. And as a matter of fact, DOIT needed a lot to get it going again. Great people, smart stuff, but they were stuck.
Mm-hmm.
So for the longest time, that was where I spent my time and energy. And I'll come back to that in a few minutes.
Okay.
In terms of the reputation of the department, I have a colleague, she's still a good colleague and friend, who is still here, Kathy Kristoff. She is the Director of Academic Technology. And she's the person who put my name in the
much to my surprise. Hmm. I happen to know that Kathy was a newer reputation and newer personally, and she's one of the best people in the country in terms of thinking about and envisioning and making academic technology things happen in higher ed. So I knew what Kathy was doing. I don't think I knew much of anything else. I had met some of the folks at national meetings before and liked them, but I didn't really know what was going on except in Kathy's shop. So, and I liked what Kathy was doing. And Kathy was so excited that I might be coming that that was fine. But I just knew that with the size of the budget and the staff, there were all of these possibilities. If they weren't doing it now, they could be. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I held out for the organization, well, I held out a vision of what an organization should be, and my vision said world class, among other things. I had five things in the vision. One was a learning organization, a customer service oriented organization, a world class organization, an honest organization, collaborative it was, and joyful. Mm-hmm. And honesty was a real key part of all of those things. So you hold this out saying you're going to be a world-class organization, and people wonder what you're talking about, but you know we now are a world-class IT organization. Mm-hmm. People look to us. And I had to have this conversation. You know, this is a world-class university. Look at where we come out of the standings. Why wouldn't you have a world-class IT department? Why would being just okay be good enough? And so we went for world-class.
And made it.
And I knew it was possible, so there you are.
Yeah. The facilities in which you work?
Well, you know, the facilities are okay. It's a building, and what we need is a really good backup data center. But we're working to make that happen. I'm not sure that we've got enough space to do it in, but I think there'll be some investments in that in the future. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's simply space. It's not beautiful space, but it's very functional. Mm-hmm. Space, and people have offices with, by and large, with walls, when a lot of our colleagues have offices with only partial walls. I'm not sure that that's not better, but mm-hmm. people like their walls. So the facilities are fine. Mm-hmm. It would be nicer if some parts of the organization were closer to the center of campus, as opposed to off here on a corner. But a help desk academic technology would be really good mm-hmm. in a more central organization, but it's okay. The culture.
Did it change while you were here?
Oh, yeah.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yeah, and people will say that all over and over and over again. It wasn't a collaborative culture. It had been built as a siloed culture. There had been a model in place called the N. Dean Myers Structural Cybernetics was a model that had been adopted by my predecessor, long gone, and then there was only interim, to bring the different IT organizations together. They had reported separately. But the N. Dean Myers model built silos and set them up in competition with each other. Mm. So this organization had a lot of units that were competitive. They wouldn't pass work across organizational units. Things fell through the cracks because of that. Customers were not, or the community, faculty, student, staff were not well taken care of. Because if you didn't know, you didn't want to send it next door because if it was a billable service, they would get the money. Or you didn't want to ask them for help because if you asked them, they would bill you for their time. It was pretty messy. So we spent a lot of time, which is, I think, why the work as director of DOIT as opposed to CIO was so important during my tenure. We spent a lot of time turning this from a very siloed organization into an organization that's much more collaborative. Folks were miserable, too. The morale was at the bottom of the barrel, and it was because they couldn't talk to each other without a billing number. Mm-hmm. I mean, in the organization, you couldn't talk to your colleague without getting a billing number from them. So, you know, it just messed things up fiercely. It let my predecessor do something. Well, I don't know. There were other ways to do it. And, I've talked to him about it. He still thinks it was the best way to go. And so maybe if he had stayed, he could have made it work. I couldn't make that model work for mm-hmm. me. So collaborative was important, and we worked really hard. And there are still huge spots in this organization, because it's a big organization, that haven't gotten it yet. You know, but it's come so far from where it was in terms of collaboration. And I'm really proud of that. Mm-hmm. No longer does the help, well, and as a matter of fact, one of the prime examples, and it says give an example, is we have the help desk sitting here and repair services sitting right next to them. If you went to the help desk with a problem, they would help you solve that problem and work like the Dickens, and it was free. If you went to the repair desk with the same problem, they would never say to you, the help desk can do it for you for free. They would take your whatever, set up a billing process, and charge you to solve that problem. And they might not be able to. They might need the help desk. Or the help desk might not be able to. They might need these services. But they never went together. We have combined them now. It's an integrated help desk and repair service. It's one-stop shopping. And it's much, much nicer for the folks out there. The other thing that was in place, the help desk is the easiest example, is if a help desk person who answered the phones, and a lot of times they're students, couldn't answer the question, they would need to refer it to somebody with more technical expertise. But those people with more technical expertise felt no obligation to respond. First of all, the help desk had to give them an account number to bill and then tell them they would be back to them within 5 days.
Oh, no.
Well, somebody who needs their computer fixed isn't going to wait for 5 days. And those poor help desk people were on the spot waiting for these people who wouldn't work for them unless they paid for it and didn't feel any obligation to respond in a hurry. So, you know, we changed all of that kind of stuff. And all I got when I got here were complaints about the help desk. And all I got when I left are people telling me how great it was to talk to somebody at the help desk, how nice this person was, how they got their problems solved. So, and that's not because everybody knows all the answers, although we built a much better set of help desk information, too, for people. But it's also because we've talked to people about collaboration and service and customer service and working together and got rid of that internal charging model that was a killer. Yeah. So that's an example. There are lots of other areas where we did the same kind of thing. How do you get the people who do academic technology talking to the people who do administrative technology when both of them are supporting the students? You know, the academic system needs all sorts of information about the students, and the registrar's information system needs that too. And, you know, you can't build separate systems. You've got to build one thing that works together. So we worked on making those kinds of things happen, having people work with the registrar together as opposed to these people saying one thing, those people saying another thing. This organization's gotten good, yeah. I think.
Yeah, I would agree.
Thank you. So
what did you like most about this position, and what things were the most challenging?
Well, this has been a phenomenal position. I just, you know, I was just so delighted to have had this opportunity. Mm-hmm. I need to say that. What I find interesting, of course, is the vastness, the huge amount of things that we are involved in, and the fact that it's never enough. You know, I mean, these are all of the things that we're paying attention to, and there's still all of this stuff to do. I find that both interesting and challenging.
Yeah.
I think one of the big challenges facing this organization and facing the university is how IT is funded currently, because it still is a bone of contention. There's not enough money for some stuff, and we spend money on other things that I think are important, but I don't know where the university sits with it. So I think the funding issue is a huge and interesting challenge left. I would find that very big and something somebody else can do. I'm glad I don't have to tackle that one. What I tackled was making it work better. Mm-hmm. I think another interesting aspect is how the central IT organization works with the rest of the campus. And, you know, how people make decisions about what it is they're going to do IT-wise that are independent as opposed to part of a larger vision. I think this place needs a bigger vision where things are part of it and where the people in the schools and departments feel some obligation to coordinate and be coordinated. They don't want to be coordinated centrally. And that means the deans have got to think differently and the chancellor has to think differently and the chief financial officer has to think differently about what the role of IT is here. Mm-hmm. But one of the great and fun things to do here was to build a network. That's different. So we have on this campus the 21st Century Network. It's a high-end network to every desktop. I had an opportunity to get funding to do that. Some of it was gift funding. Some of it was a different billing model that worked. And we've got a network in place on this campus that's just fine. It won't be fine in 5 years, of course. It's got to be continually invested in, but it's just fine. We had fun doing it, and it's just about done. Perry, who is our network director, said to me that we're just about ready to celebrate the completion of it, and I'm very, very excited about that. Beyond that, I think working in the area of networking nationally has been really exciting, and making this university a really important part of the national network infrastructure has been exciting. So we here in Madison have a fine connection to the world that we've put in place in the last 2 years. And we have actively encouraged our partners in both the Big Ten on one side, and more specifically in Minnesota and in Iowa, to be part of a larger network infrastructure. So we're building a high-speed network with University of Minnesota, Iowa State, and Iowa. That takes us all down the Wisconsin path and down another path to Chicago and Kansas City and then to the world. And more than that, I am the co-founder of an organization called the Northern Tier Network Consortium.
Yeah, what is that?
Well, you know, it's just a group of friends. mostly IT leaders in the states that touch the Canadian border and one layer below. And if you look at a map of networking, educational networking in the United States, you'll see all sorts of stuff running in the south, running in the west, and running in the east. And that northern part of the country is just empty. It's just empty. And I was on the board of on a major committee of Internet 2, which is our national organization, with another female colleague. Her name is Bonnie Neese from North Dakota State University. And I kept saying, why is it you keep going here? What about this? And Bonnie looked at me and said, yeah, what about this? And finally she and I got the message that if we want to do anything about the what about this, we'd have to do it ourselves. So we invited our friends from these states, the IT leaders, to think with us about how we might do that. And we've put together an organization that is using each other not to build a network. We're building it in chunks. So what we're building in Minnesota and Iowa will be a big hunk of it. Seattle already had a lot of stuff going, and they're reaching out to the western part of Washington and to Idaho. And, you know, I just got a message from somebody, and it was either a North Dakota senator or a South Dakota senator, has just talked about the Northern Tier Network in Congress and has gotten an appropriation for his state for $5 million to connect to it.
Oh, my gosh.
So, you know, we've had an opportunity to really move a network forward in mm-hmm. this part of the country. It's not done, mm-hmm. but it's been great, great fun. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things that it was extraordinarily challenging.
Yeah.
And grand fun. Grand fun. We expect to have Boreas, which is the one in the Minnesota, Iowa, and Madison, up and running in January.
Boreas?
Broadband Optical Research Education Academic and Science Network.
Right. But you know, you find a word that's got a few things you want in it, and then you force all the other words to fit. And besides, we have an engineer on the team. You know, Boreas is the god of the north winds, and we have an engineer on the team that looks like the god of the north winds. So.
That's great.
Okay.
Now I'm getting, the next question is kind of back to campus, your involvement in campus administration. I think that question probably related to the chief information officer responsibility.
Yeah, and it's more than that. You know, this campus is a funny place. So I've always been involved with whatever was going on in the provost's office, but I've never been, until the last year or so, I wasn't involved in what was going on in the chancellor's office. And in the last year, I was asked to sit on the chancellor's cabinet. I'm not sure. You know, my colleagues around the country keep asking, do you sit on the president's cabinet? Right? Most places, the president as opposed to a chancellor. It's one of the questions that's out there. I'm not sure that it makes all the difference in the world, but I think if you're really trying to influence IT campus-wide, you need to know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know exactly where on this campus what's going on is tackled.
Mm-hmm.
When I came, I was part of the Dean's Council, but at some point the deans decided they only wanted deans
oh.
on the Dean's Council, so they moved several of us off. And that was really a great source of information and connection.
Sure.
And, you know, it was interesting because I made a decision. There's plenty to do here, and it may have been the wrong decision. And I said, well, hell, if the deans don't want me, then I'm not going to bother with them. You know?
Mm-hmm.
And except for some of them who are clearly friends. But there was plenty to do,
mm-hmm.
and I would hope that the next CIO has more involvement in very high-level campus administration because we're spending lots of money. This is a real strategic resource. I mean, we're going into accreditation right now, and people need to pay attention to IT. It's
mm-hmm.
going to be a top issue,
mm-hmm.
especially how we use IT in teaching and learning
mm-hmm.
in the accreditation process. And there are huge issues in IT right now in a place like this in terms of privacy and take Social Security numbers. You hear all of these instances.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we're only lucky here. It's not that we're smarter and that we're well protected. We've just been lucky in that we don't have hundreds of thousands of Social Security numbers floating out there.
Mm-hmm.
And we've got them here in Madison for the entire system, not just for Madison,
oh, yeah.
but
mm-hmm.
for 180,000 students, however many employees the system has. So we're a tremendous risk, and I think the university needs to address that at the highest levels, not leave that to whoever is trying to get systems together and fighting with people or arguing with people in the functional departments, say the payroll department, about how many times they can have a Social Security number in the record. You know, it's got to be at a different level than that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why it matters to be a CIO as opposed to a director of doing.
And
the next person's got to have that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you think the person will? Do you think that there's...
Well, I think that there's some inclination to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. You know, you can't tell until it gets
True.
Here what our president's, our chancellor's going to do, what our provost is going to do, what
yeah.
the deans are going to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
We have a new provost.
Right, right.
We have a lot of new deans. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I hope so.
Yeah.
I drafted a job description. I don't know where... I know it's being put in front of people, or some job description, I'm sure Pat Farrell has redrafted it, will be put in front of people in the next week or so. I hope that they stress the importance of this overall campus oversight.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, campus administration, campus governance. Well, I think I just said that
yeah.
to some extent. And I've been on lots of campus committees, and, you know, besides,
I'm sure. right.
besides this.
Right.
The climate for women
yeah.
here. Well,
what do you think?
Well, you know, I wonder, I think it's really mixed. Our interim provost was a real good friend of mine. And, you know, I watched that process, and I don't know how much of it is about being a woman versus how much of it is something else. But the fact that she couldn't get through the search committee, I don't know. I've watched what the medical school has done to... the woman who runs the anesthesiology department, and you say, what is this? And it is actually, it's not the medical school. The medical school tried to depart. It's a tenure committee someplace over there in history or something. So I don't think we take good care of women on this campus. I think that there are a couple of more women deans, and that's good, and maybe that will make a difference. But I've always wondered if I had come in as a male and wore a suit and tie, if the deans would not have let me stay on their committee.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know whether, you know, I'm not a paranoid person,
right.
but you do ask those questions, especially
mm-hmm.
when you see, you know, women trying for the provostship over and over again and not getting it.
Mm-hmm.
Women candidates for the big dean job, letters in science, and not getting it. And when you talk to them, and I mean, I've never felt mistreated because of my sex, except I wonder about the deans. But when you talk to these women in the academic positions, you know that sexism is still there, rearing its head all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the climate for women could be better. And I'm very proud of my organization, which has this organization, which has as many women directors as male directors, which interestingly enough has a woman running, had three women running three network groups, which are almost always male groups, has a woman running the big systems engineering group, which is almost always a male job. So, you know, we've really managed to do well here. Mm-hmm. Who knows what happens, you know, next, because I've left and my deputy, who was a female, left a year before me, and so this the top here has changed too. Mm-hmm. But certainly we've done okay. I think women in computing have had better opportunities than other places, because when the profession started, it was so new, they needed us from wherever we came.
Yeah.
From. They didn't care whether you wore pants or not.
And it started in business more than in academia, right? Mm-hmm. So a lot of you people like you probably came from the business world.
Probably.
Yeah.
Well, there were math teachers, and we just came from wherever.
You know? I suppose, right? Right.
Yeah. So I don't... I think we need to think about it more. Mm-hmm. It's going to be interesting. You know, the chancellor's going to leave in a couple of years. It won't be interesting to see what happens there.
Yeah.
There are other great universities with female presidents. It would be fun. Because I think our nation could use a female president, too. Anybody? Well,
be nice
never mind.
To happen in our lifetime.
Yeah.
No. How about professional organizations? I'm sure there are a lot of them, and you probably were very much involved.
Yeah, I've been active. I was active. Certainly, I helped form the Northern Tier Network Consortium.
Right.
I've been active in Internet, too, which is really important, and our other big network organization, which is called National Lambda Rail. So I've been there. EDUCAUSE is our biggest organization, and I've been on committees and done yeoman work there. There are others, most of them.
How about awards and honors?
I got this award from EDUCAUSE last year, and it was a biggie.
Yes.
It was a biggie, so it was wonderful to be recognized as a leader in IT in the profession. My first award I got that I can remember was called the Mercedes Mentoring Award, and it was in Chicago, and Mercedes-Benz was doing a Women's Mentoring Award, and it was a number one, and my staff saw it and submitted my name.
This is when you were at Northwestern?
At Northwestern.
Really?
Yeah, and so I have a plaque with a little Mercedes-Benz on it. I wanted a real Mercedes-Benz, of course. But so it's that kind of stuff. I have, it's that kind of stuff.
Well, talk about the EDUCAUSE Award, excuse me.
Well, EDUCAUSE gives one, two, or three awards a year for people who've done, have done major contributions to the profession, and this was award for being a leader, for having influenced a lot of people in a lot of directions. It wasn't for any specific thing.
Mm-hmm.
It was really a lifetime achievement award. I guess it's almost the old geezers award, you know. But when you look at the old geezers you're in company with, it's very,
very,
very, very nice. Some of the people who I think are really world-class are winners of this award before me. So I was honored and delighted to receive this. And I had a great time writing a talk for it and giving a speech.
It was a great talk.
And it was a good talk. It was one of my good ones.
Yeah.
So, that's it.
Well, let's talk about life after work. When you were working, how did you balance your work and your other life?
Well, of course my children are long gone now. So God knows back when they were around, it was extraordinarily difficult. And I look at young women today. I had an appointment with my audiologist today, who's a young woman, and talking about, getting up at 5 a.m. to change her kids' whatever and trying to exercise. And all I could think of was it was hard. It was this balance was hard. More recently, work was a very large part of my life. But I think I was blessed here to have a wonderful staff, too. So I wasn't working. My first year or two, I worked very long days. Mm-hmm. But after that, I wasn't working extraordinarily as 50 hours a week, maybe, mm-hmm. which gave me time to do other things, and I'm a quilter. So what I wanted to do was take time to quilt.
Uh-huh.
And I did. And I've been sewing all my life, but mm-hmm. it was at Northwestern after my kids were gone that I took up quilting. And I took a class here in Madison at a place called Stitcher's Crossing out on Mineral Point Road from a teacher named Judy Hassider. And I just hit it off with her. She was wonderful. She talks about thinking while you're quilting, you know, how to think through this thing. If you look at anything, you can figure out mathematically and logically how to build it. And I fell in love with her and her style, and she's helped me become a really serious quilter. So for me, what I did when I wasn't working was quilt. Other than going, the theater in Madison is wonderful, the concerts in Madison, and I have friends, and so I would do things and go places, but what I really wanted to do was quilt. And if I had a bad day at work, I couldn't wait to get home and get down at my machine and start putting pieces together. And it was sort of a Zen experience. So that's where I found my balance, as well as in my garden. I had a wonderful garden on the far west side. When I bought the house, there was nothing in it. And I decided I was going to grow flowers, and I dug up trash trees and plowed up a plot, you know, 20 feet wide and 200 feet long, and it is a wild, wild perennial garden. So, you know, that's where I found my mm-hmm. solace. Mm-hmm. I have family, children all around the country, so I raised my sister's three kids besides the two I had when my sister became really ill. I took hers, and so I have these five children, and beyond that, there with those five, there are seven grandchildren. Hmm. And, you know, part of what I want to do is float around and see them. So if I had an opportunity to travel and it was any place near where they were, I would take another day or two and visit children and grandchildren. And that's really what I do, but it's the quilting. I'm back here in Madison to go to the Seavers School of Fiber Arts on Washington Island for 5 days.
Oh, really?
I'm leaving tomorrow
quilt.
Yeah.
Now,
to
isn't
a quilter's retreat.
What didn't I hear when you were gave your EDUCAUSE talk that this is a major part of your retirement too, the quilting that you do?
Well, I want it to be. I spent 2 days yesterday and the day before with a long arm quilter, which is another thing, in Reedsburg, and she's an award winning quilter, and she has two huge machines in her basement. In her studio, really. And she rented me one of those machines for 2 days. Mm. And I also said, Linda, I don't want to just rent your machine. I want to rent you, too, because I really don't know what I'm doing. I have taken a class from her, and I want to do two quilt tops. So, you know, there's one thing to piece the quilt together, but then you've got to take the top, the center, and the bottom, and the stitching that you do to hold them together is the quilting. I'm a piecer. I'm not a quilter.
I see.
So I spent 2 days with her quilting. Putting mm-hmm. on her long arm machines and having her tell me, yeah, oh, let me help you here. And it was wonderful. So the question is, do I buy one of these machines? And they are 14 feet long and 8 feet wide. It costs $15,000 to $20,000, or you can go up to $30,000. But if you do that, I think you need to set up a cottage industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure I want to set up a cottage industry. There are more modest pieces of equipment that won't let you do quite as much, but...
Hmm.
I might do that. I was thinking I would like to teach quilting courses. I think I could do that. I just haven't gotten established enough in Pittsburgh yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I have my daughter has a dear friend who does yarn stuff, and each year she throws a big event once a year and focused around knitting, and I thought maybe I would talk her into a corner next year for quilting, and we would begin to see that how I could play this out, because after a while you have more quilts than you need. You know, I thought I have three beds in my house, so I could have up to 36 quilts of my own, which would be a change once a month for each bed.
Oh my!
But you got to find a place to put them in the meantime.
That's
not going to work.
Right.
But I love doing it. It's and I never knew I had any artistic skill, and I really make beautiful quilts. Mm-hmm. So yeah, that's my. That's it. And I've got a couple of little consulting, IT consulting jobs, or higher ed
mm-hmm.
IT organization consulting jobs coming up. And
I have a consulting firm that would like to put me on their roster and have me do more than I might be willing to do, but I haven't had a chance to talk about it yet. You know, mm-hmm. I moved, I had two grandchildren with me for 3 weeks. Figured this out. The house I bought in Pittsburgh was built in 1882 or 3 or something like that. So it's very old, and it's going to take a lot of my energy to make it. I mean, it's old, and it's not in bad shape, but it's not in good shape, mm-hmm. so it's going to take a lot of energy to spruce it up. So I've got a lot to do. A little bit of consulting, a lot of quilting, some work around the house. I don't have a garden there that's worth anything. It's diddly squat, and so I need to figure out how to do the garden. There's plenty.
Yeah.
I'm looking forward to this.
I think you just answered the last question. What do you miss about your position in the University of Wisconsin-Madison? What do you not miss? It sounds like you're not going to have any time to miss anything here, really.
No, but you know, I will miss the people. I made some wonderful friends here. It took me the longest time. I fussed at first about how nice Wisconsin people were. It just drove me crazy because they wouldn't talk back to me. You know,
oh,
I would
I
say
see.
The most outrageous yeah. things. Let's do this. And I wouldn't get anything back. And, you know, and then they wouldn't do it. And finally I got, you know, you're too damn nice. You're just really nice. I need you to tell me when I'm off base, because I am a lot of the time. And the way we do this is with a dialogue.
Yeah.
So, but you know, they are nice, and I'm going to miss them.
Yeah. Well, you have to keep coming back.
I do.
Yeah.
So that's my story.
Well, I want...
It's been a great career in technology and in matter, and I never dreamt it. You know, I'm just a fireman's kid. I call myself a street kid from Queens.
Huh.
And my father would have never dreamt it either if he was alive.
Now, where were you in your career when your father passed away?
I was in California. I was at Holy Cross Hospital.
Okay. So you had done quite a few things by then.
I had, and he was delighted. Yeah,
right.
He was very proud
right.
of me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And in the meantime, my sister was getting her PhD. You know, I mean, so he was
happy.
He did okay with his girls.
Yeah.
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 And with his son, which was an interesting story. My brother was in school he wanted to be a potter. He's an artist. And, but before, when he graduated from high school, he took the plumbers. The union exam.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't get into the plumbers union unless you've got a relative. Well, my brother is another one of these really smart people, and he came out top. And the plumbers union wanted him, and that's when my father pulled him out of college and said, you're going to be a plumber. My brother is extraordinarily successful. He leads huge projects, like, you know,
yeah.
big labs at the University
right.
of Southern California.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, does he still do his art?
He pots.
He
yes.
does
He's
still.
Got his own kiln, and
okay.
he pots all the time.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, listen, thank you so much. I'm so glad we found the time to do this.
I don't know. Yeah, thank you. Well, it was fun. It's been an interesting
It's been
an interesting trip.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, good for you.